After last week's introduction, I want to just give one more, a few final introductory remarks, and then we're going to move into the packet which I gave you. And the packet which I gave you, you'll see, is hopefully very helpful. And each week when we tackle a new passage from the Talmud, we'll hopefully get a few more of these. And the main point of whatever I'm giving you is that you keep it and that you read through it. Okay, and hopefully it will be some of it will be self-explanatory. Some of it specifically explains a Talmudic passage or helps explain a Talmudic phrase which appears. And I gave you one specifically which we're going to be using tonight in the packet which I gave you. Yeah, you'll see from the title page, Understanding the Talmud by Rabbi Yitzchak Feigenbaum. So a lot of the things which are in this packet come from this book, Understanding the Talmud, a systematic guide to Talmudic structure and methodology. When I got this book, it was already out of print. So it was probably self-printed. It's fantastic. If you really want to make your way through Talmud, this is a great, great, great tool. Everything except for the phrases, which he translates, but the phrases, as you'll see when we look at some of the passages which I photocopied for you, the phrases from the Talmud, it's in its Hebrew Aramaic, and the explanation is pretty straightforward, and he's pretty thorough, which is fantastic. There's a similar book, although it's not as thorough, and that is this one, the Practical Talmud Dictionary, which has a lot more entries because it's more of a dictionary. This one is a methodology book. The Feigenbaum book is a methodology book, but this one is a Talmudic dictionary which takes phrases and words. And gives it's like a dictionary. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's a dictionary. Sometimes they'll give a context in which it appears, and that is the Frank dictionary. Probably the best work, dictionary-wise, on the Talmud is this little, very very fat book, which is known by its author's name, the Jastrow. It's the Jastrow dictionary. We actually have one, I think, a two-volume one up there on the shelf, and. This is extremely thorough. Basically, there's not a word in the Talmud that isn't in here. It was put together by Professor Marcus Jastrow. It's a dictionary of the Targum, Talmud Bavli, Yerushalmi, Midrashic Literature. These are books whose names I mentioned last week. And he'll often, if you can't find the word that you're looking for, it's because he has it broken down sometimes by its root, sometimes by its actual format, sometimes with the prefix, with the suffix. So you have to sometimes do a little searching, but this book, it's an I don't even remember when it was published. Probably early 1900s, if I'm not mistaken. Well, that's not when it was published. The Judaica Press printed it in 1922, but this was 1971. No, that can't be. I think it was earlier than that. I don't know. Anyway, I don't know when it was first published, but it is fantastic and it is essential to Talmud study. The last couple of books which I have here are books that I picked up when I was studying Yeshiva in Israel. One of them is called the Otsar HaTalmud, and it's for those who can speak Hebrew, read and speak Hebrew, and it takes a number of phrases in the Talmud, not so much the methodology side, but concepts. And this is a lexicon which is also fantastic and extremely thorough, I find it to be extremely helpful. And the last book which I have here is just called Darkei Limud. And in the next few weeks, I'm going to translate some of this stuff, which is in Hebrew. It just gives basic tools for how to make your way through a Talmudic passage. And it's you see, it's a small pamphlet, but it is also quite wonderful. Okay, so tonight, what we're going to be doing, so if you open up the package for a second, you'll see that what you have here are a few pages from the introduction, of Feigenbaum's book. Okay, I didn't want to cut and paste because I just didn't have the time for that, so I just gave you the pages in their fullness. So since you don't have the actual book, so you don't really need to look at what this book does not do, but you'll see history and style of the Gemara, Mishnah, Braita, Gemara. Those passages are well worth the read. I'm not going to spend the time going through them with you because you can do that on your own. Turn to the page that says on the top, vocalization and terms used in this book. What I would like you to look at now is where it says terms used in this book. So just to look at the outline that he has here. A statement. Okay, now again, we don't have the book, but we have some passages from it. But just to get an idea of how the Talmud works. So he says there, the Gemara presents several types of statements. So as we go through some of the things which we'll be seeing, we can ask the question when we come across any statement, what is this statement doing for us? Is it giving us information? Is it a legal statement? Is it an explanatory statement, a qualifying statement? Or is it an argument? What we're going to find in that a lot of the things which are said, I think I said last week that the Talmud is a flow. It's a conversation. It's a flowing conversation, and it goes sometimes off in different tangents in different directions, but each statement that comes falls into one of these categories, or as we're going to see in a second, a different types of questions. So you have in section B, he talks about information questions. Its purpose is to ask for one of three types of information: the resolution of a legal issue, the authorship of a citation, which we're going to see a little bit tonight, the Torah or the logical source of a statement, which we will also see tonight. Sometimes you have an attack question, where somebody will say, all right, you just made a statement. Hold on a second, that statement isn't true, or it's inaccurate, or I have a contradictory statement. And then what the Talmud will do is they'll say, all right, there are two statements which have been stated as fact, or they've been stated as information which is out there in the ether, but they're contradictory. What do we do with that contradiction? How do we resolve the contradiction? How are they not really contradictory? Because this statement is really talking about a very specific kind of case. And this statement, which seems to contradict, but is talking about a very specific kind of case, we're going to see some of that tonight as well. Okay, turn, if you look at the next page where it says D, so D has answers. It's just on the other, if you haven't folded, we're over here, okay, down here, D, where he has answers. Okay, so there are a number of different ways in which the Talmud will give us an answer or a response to one of the questions which may have come, whether it's giving the information, whether it's responding to an attack, saying why the attack is either founded or unfounded. If it's founded, but here's my response, or here it's unfounded because your information is wrong, or it's inaccurate, or you're talking about a different kind of scenario or a different case. Turn to the top of the next page where you're going to see like a small flowchart. Okay, sometimes you have flowcharts which follow the method of A, where there is a question, and then the Talmud gives one answer, and then it may ask a question about that answer. And then without resolving that question, it may say, you know what, that's a good question. I don't have an answer to that question, so let me give you another answer to the original question. Okay, so that's just a normal way that the Talmud may flow. Now you look at it, you say, what on earth is going on here? But you have to realize that sometimes a question is responding immediately to an answer which is given, which some rabbi found to be unacceptable or incomplete. And so the Talmud says, good point. And then it moves on to try to address the original question. Sometimes it will do something a little different. There'll be a question, and then there's an answer given. And then there's a question on that answer, and somebody says, oh no, I have an answer to that question that you're asking. And since the second question, in other words, the question on the first answer which was given, is answered, what does that mean about the first answer? That it's a good answer. Okay, because let's say you say 2 plus, I say, what's 2 plus 2? And you say 4. Somebody say, I think that it's 22. Say, no, I wasn't asking what 2 next to 2 is, I'm asking about 2 plus 2. Well then my question wasn't a good question. And therefore, the original answer, saying that 2 plus 2 is 4, is a good answer. Because the question that was asked on my answer has been answered, resolved, I don't want to say invalidated, because the question is typically a good question, but once it's resolved, it removes whatever question I had on the original answer. So we just go back to the original answer. Okay, it's logical flows. When you understand that there's a method, Then the Talmud can begin to make sense. But you have to understand that there's a method. Yes?
Isn't it assuming that the answer is positive? If something brings on another question and your answer disputes it, that's still an answer.
So, right. It always depends. And that's why one of the points that he actually makes in his explaining the methodology is that, here, actually, take a look at the bottom. Take a look at the bottom of the page. This is important. We're going to read through all of these. Okay? General study rules. The following rules tell you how to study Gemara. Do not use pronouns. Okay? In other words, let's say there's a question. Rabbi Yehuda asked a question, let's say. And now we want to answer the question. So, who's answering the question? We don't say, his answer is, we have to say, Rabbi Yehuda's answer. Maybe somebody else is answering on behalf of Rabbi Yehuda. Who is that person? Don't use pronouns. Don't say, the Gemara is asking a question. Now, sometimes the Gemara is asking a question. But who in the Gemara is asking the question? So you don't want to use pronouns. The more you're able to talk it out, the better chance you'll have at understanding what's going on. Because as I mentioned last week, sometimes the Gemara will give you a... See, I just did. Okay, sometimes the Talmud, in the flow of what's going on, we're going to get a one-word answer or a two-word answer. What does that mean? You have to fill in the blanks. You have to be able to explain what's going on. And if you can't, or if the sentence that you're coming up with doesn't make sense, it's a very simple rule. You're reading it wrong. Okay, so you have to come up and make it sense. I do this with my kids. We're just, some of my kids are learning how to actually read. So they put together a word in English. So, and let's say they're reading it wrong. So if it's a word which they know, I say, does that word make any sense? They say, no. So then try again. And that's the basic rule of comprehension. If it doesn't make sense, then you're not reading it right. Okay? The biggest challenge we're going to find in all of Talmud, obviously the language. Okay, there are two big challenges. One is the language, but hopefully with the right tools and being able to use those, you can overcome the language. The biggest challenge in Talmud is punctuation. Figuring out where's the sentence, where's a question mark, where's an exclamation mark, and how that question is to be understood. What kind of, is it a rhetorical question, or is it an attack question, and therefore, what is the actual punctuation? Sometimes the punctuation mark of a question is actually an exclamation. That can't be! It's a question. But obviously, that can't be is an exclamation mark. Whenever the Gemara quotes something, I'm now on number two. Whenever the Gemara quotes something or someone, be sure to note precisely where the quote ends. Right? Remember, I said punctuation. Which part of the quote is relevant to the Gemara's discussion? Okay, we're going to see that sometimes when it comes to the quotation of a verse. It's always important to be aware, number three, of whether the person speaking is a Tana or an Amora. I would say that for our purposes, it's not as important. It's important in a halachic sense, because whenever we talk about the halacha and the final decision of law, we usually go back to an earlier person. So it's helpful to know if somebody's a Tana. Tana is from the Mishnaic period, therefore earlier, versus an Amora from the Talmudic period, and therefore later, because it helps us know the law. So if an Amora, that's a later rabbi, quotes a Tana that has greater authority than an Amora who's quoting an Amora, because an Amora quoting an Amora is quoting somebody who's later. In the Talmud, you're going to see most conversations are going to be from later period rabbis. That's who appear in the Gemara. However, very often, they'll quote a Tana. And if they quote a Tana, then the conversation will be recounted for us by dint of being a Tanaitic, an earlier conversation or an earlier debate. So that's why he says it's important to be aware. For our purposes, that's a later stage understanding. Okay, we don't have to get to that point yet. We're trying to figure out the flow. At every step, ask yourself whether what follows is an information question, attack question. Okay, so these are things which I mentioned as we went through the earlier outline. These are general study review rules. Okay, the rest of the things which we have here are things which we're going to see as we go through the Talmud. And so let's turn to the back of the booklet. I try to make it easier that way so that we can look at the Talmud. We can always turn back to this side of the page when we're doing this. Okay? Now, the case which I brought, I just took a relatively random page. It happens to be something which was recently studied in the Daf Yomi, but that's not why I picked it. I picked it because I had a small single volume Gemara Makos in my house, and so I said, I'll just take something from there. And this was something which I thought that people could relate to. Okay, there's a rule in the Torah. The rule in the Torah is that any kind of case that needs to be adjudicated, there need to be two witnesses. Okay, two witnesses. That's a verse in the Torah, which we're actually going to see quoted in the Mishnah here. If you remember last week, how do we know when something is a Mishnah? Remembers?
It says Mishnah.
Right? It says Masni with an apostrophe, and that is the Talmudic way of saying Mishnah, Masnisin, or Matnitin, for those who don't like myself. Okay? Matnitin or Masnisin, that's a Mishnah. So when you see those four letters with an apostrophe, that indicates a Mishnah. That could appear anywhere in the page, in the bulk text of the Talmud. Okay? It happens to be that this Mishnah just happens to start at the top of the page. That is not it's not a rule. It doesn't have to. It just, when the flow of the Gemara happens to finish talking about the previous Mishnah, then the next Mishnah begins. This one happens to begin at the beginning of the page. Okay? And where is the Gemara going to be?
Okay.
Right, Gimel Mem, right? It's about a third of the way down, halfway through the thin lines of the Talmudic section, before the lines get a little wider. Okay? Okay. So that's what we do. Anyone remember what that little aleph at the very top is going to tell us?
Rambam.
Okay, that sends us to the Rambam, to the Ein Mishpat Nir Mitzvah. It's a footnote that sends us to the top right. What number footnote is this in this chapter? Anyone remember? You have to look at the Memches, right, Phil? So what number is Memches? 48. Good. And this is the first one on the page. So it tells us that Maimon, remember, Maimonides, discusses in Perek Dalet, that's chapter 4. I'm in the top right corner, the very top right corner of the page, in his tiny Rashi script letters. Mehilchos Edus, so it's the laws of testimony, Halacha Aleph. So if you want to see where this Mishnah is discussed in a halachic sense in the Rambam, you open up the Mishnah Torah, you find Hilchos Edus. How do you know where that is? You look in the chart which I gave you last week. Right? And where is Hilchos Edus? Which book of the Yad HaChazaka? If you have it, I see. I don't. It's my book. Here it is. I follow in the chart. Edus is in Shoftim. Okay, so you have to find a book of Shoftim in the Rambam. Then you find the section which is Hilchos Edus. You look for chapter 4, Halakha Aleph. Okay, I wasn't planning to look through all these things, but I'm showing you how you do that, how you go about doing that. Okay? So let's take a look. Now, obviously, as I said before, the main goal here is to figure out punctuation. So we have to, a base knowledge of Hebrew is helpful, of course, and essential, really. But we're going to work through it together. And before you get into the Talmud, you always have to know what the Mishnah is saying. Hayu shnayim. Hayu means there were. Shnayim. Two. Two what? Two people. Okay? We're going to find out if they're witnesses. That's what the question of the Talmud is. Ro'in. What is ro'in? It comes from the word ro'eh to see. Ro'in. Now, in the Talmud, since the Talmud is primarily written in Aramaic, so a word like that we might have in Hebrew to be ro'im in the plural would actually end with a nun. Okay? It's the same thing. Ro'im with a mem, ro'in with a nun is the same, means the same thing. That they're two people, plural, seeing. Oto, or oso. Two people are seeing oto, or oso. They're seeing, so what does that mean? Could mean him, could mean it, something. Okay, they're seeing whatever it is that they're seeing. Right, okay, they're seeing the same thing. So now, what's the next word? It looks like a character from the book of Ruth, right? Machlon. Well, that's not what it is, because that doesn't make any sense. They're not seeing a guy named Machlon. So what do I have to say? Mechalon, correct, mechalon. So again, it has to make sense. So you have to, if you're reading a word and it doesn't make any sense whatsoever, then the first rule is you're punctuating it wrong. Okay, so you have to repunctuate. You have to revowelize the word, and then try it again. Hayu shnayim roin oso mechalom ze. So two people are seeing it, him, it, whatever, from this window. Ushnayim and two roin oso mechalom ze, and two people see from a different window. Okay, now this is also something to note. When the Talmud repeats itself, look at these two lines. Look at these two lines. The Talmud is basically saying the same thing twice. Okay, that when you see a repeat like that, there's sometimes a very tiny change, but sometimes the repeat is, it helps you punctuate. So if I see Hayu Shnayim Roen Oso Mechalon Ze, Ushnayim Roen Oso Mechalon Ze. Ooh, wait a second, I just read the same thing twice. So what does that mean? That I missed the punctuation mark. And it means that the first phrase ended where the repeat began. So how do I know where the punctuation is if I'm reading through this? You have to pay attention to what you just said. So when we read it the first time, we actually did it right. But Hayushnayim Rono Somechalon Zeh, that's pause number one. Hushnayim Rono Somechalon Zeh, pause number two. Because this is basically the same phrase. So what's the Mishnah doing for us? It's setting up a case. What's the case? You have two people in one window, two people in another window. Okay? And so we know that we punctuated correctly because we have two phrases that are basically the same. And so the first one ended at Zeh, and the second one ended at Zeh. Okay? That's another easy rule to remember. The Echad Masre both. And one person is Masre Bo. Masre. So there's a phrase that you need to know. Hasra. Okay, when it comes to any kind of case where there are witnesses, Hasra is spelled Hey, Tav, Reish, Aleph, Hey. Any kind of case where there are witnesses. The only way the witness's testimony can count for anything that can allow for a punishment to the person who commits a crime is if the witnesses warned the individual, you're about to commit a crime, you're about to do a violation of the Torah, you recognize that there's a punishment associated with this, and if you go ahead and continue to do what you're doing, we will bear witness against you in a court of law, and you're going to get the punishment. And the person basically has to say, I got it, I know, I understand, I don't care. that's how, and that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to punish somebody for anything, because how many circumstances are actually going to come up where the witnesses have a chance to give a warning and in the right way, and the person says, I got it, I understand, and I don't care. You know, you're really not supposed to murder the individual that you're about to murder. Okay, like how often does that happen? Oh, you know, now that you mention it, maybe I won't do that. Okay, right? I mean, or anything. You know, you're about to steal. You know, stealing is against the Torah, and we see what you're about to do. Right? How often does that kind of situation happen? It doesn't happen that often. And that's one of the reasons why a full punishment by law is very difficult to achieve. Does that mean that there isn't methods and ways to cause justice to prevail? No. That's a much longer conversation. But the point is, now what do you think the case is that the Mishnah is trying to understand? Okay, again, we have two people. Let's set the scene. There's where all these papers are, that's where the act is taking place, whatever the act is. Okay? There's a window overhead. There's a window overhead. In that window, how many people?
Two
people. That window, how many people? Two people. And down here, you have the crime that's going to be committed. And you have how many people present down there?
One.
Other than the people involved? One. And what's that one person doing?
Perpetrating.
Okay? Giving a warning. Okay? Echad Masrebo Be'emza. In the middle. So now the Talmud is going to ask us a question. Okay? And here's the question. Or the Mishnah. Or maybe it's not really the question. Okay? Now let's see if we could find the punctuation. Let's see if we can find where the comma is and where the next period is. Okay? You know what? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to see if you could find a repeated phrase in the next couple of lines. It could be a phrase of one word. Well, not one word. One word is a little harder. But a phrase of two, three, or four words. See if you could find a phrase which repeats itself. Okay? Because that's going to help us find the next major period. Okay, we're in Makos, Daf Vav, and Mebeis in the Mishnah. Okay, we're looking for a repeated phrase. Two or more words. Alright, I heard it. Very good. Hare Elu. So what does Hare Elu mean? Elu? Elu means these. These are. So Hare means these are, or this group are. So now, let's understand. Everybody see what we're talking about? On line 4 of the page, Harei Elu, and towards the end of the line, also Harei Elu. Okay? So that is a key that's meant to help us figure out our punctuation. So let's go back to the third word on line 3. Bizman. Zman means time. At the time. Shemiktsasan. Now you have to find the root of that word. What's the root? So if you know a little bit of Hebrew, you know that a shin is a preview. It's a preview, it's a prefix that means that. Okay, mem is also a prefix. Depending on the context, it might change its meaning. So what's the root here? Kuf, sadi, tuf, which means small or a portion. Our portion, okay? Bizman shemiktsasan. So at a time when a portion of, well, the nun means them. So a portion of them. What's the next word? Ro'in. We've had that word a couple times. What does ro'in mean?
See.
Okay, so when a portion of them see, elu es elu. Elu es elu. That's a phrase which is used in Hebrew. When we might, in English we would say one another, okay, or these are seeing these. So when some of them, of these, are seeing some of them of these. So now, what does that mean? The two over there, what do they see? Maybe they're seeing the two over there. Maybe the guy who's warning. Okay, we're going to find out all the possible scenarios. Okay, but what are we trying to do? We're trying to see if all the people who are here are all considered to be one unit of the witnessing that's supposed to take place. Okay? How does that work? These guys are in this building. Are they together? The two guys in this building? Yes, they're together. These guys are in this building. Are they together? Yes. Are these guys or these guys together with one another? Okay? Ah, right. So that's a little more complicated. So what is the Mishnah telling us? If these guys see this guy, so they're aware of each other, they're all watching the same scenario down here. So what does that mean? Ah, well, maybe they are seeing the same thing. Are they all witnesses to the same thing? Absolutely. Anybody here been to a wedding?
Yes.
Okay. So you know, sometimes when they call up the witnesses to watch the actual giving of the ring, they make an announcement. What do they say? You are the witnesses to the exclusion of everybody else here. Why? Because everybody else in the room is watching the same thing that you guys are watching. But what's the problem with everybody else in the room? Right? They may not be kosher witnesses. Why? You have a lot of relatives, right? You have a lot of relatives. Relatives to the bride and the groom. Relatives to the witnesses. Relatives to anything. And relatives to one another, or relatives to anybody who's involved in the case, become puzzled. They're not allowed. And they actually invalidate whatever it is that's going on. That's one of the rules of relatives. So this is just background information that you need when you understand how witnesses work, etc. So that's information which is helpful. But that's the one. That's the reason why they make that announcement. So yes.
If something is happening, transpiring, I see it. He sees it.
Right.
Why do we have to also be aware of each other? Why do the witnesses have to recognize the other witness when we could be looking at the same thing? Why is it important for me to know who he is?
Right. So there are different witnesses that serve different functions. Okay, witnesses to ascertain, for example, that something happened. That's fine. Okay, fair enough. You saw it. Everybody knows it happened. Okay, that's one kind of witness. There's another kind of witness that can actually bring about the punishment. So it doesn't matter that you saw it. Doesn't matter that he saw it. What matters is that the warning was issued by a valid set of witnesses. And you need to have two, as we're going to soon see. And they need to be together, as we're going to see. And if they're not together, you can have all the information. You can have seen everything point blank. You saw everything. And he could see everything point blank. You see everything. Doesn't matter. If you're not a group, if you're not a pair, if you're not unified, any witnessing in the world cannot bring about a punishment to the individuals who are involved, in other words, to the perpetrator of a crime.
What about if you have two at each window? If you have two at the window.
Okay, so now you're getting, now you're becoming a Talmudic rabbi. Okay, that's what you're doing here. Okay, so let's make our way through it. Okay, so what have we seen so far, folks? One key that we have seen in understanding how to read through Talmud is to find a phrase that repeats itself, because that helps you punctuate. If you can't punctuate, you're not going to get through a passage in the Talmud. Okay, so find a phrase that repeats itself. Now, Bizman Shemitzas and Roane Elus Elu. When some of them see one another, Hare Elu Edus Achas. We saw the phrase Hare Elu. Hare Elu is telling us a solution. A solution to our problem. Hare Elu, these are. So how do you know what these are? Well, you have to find the rest of the phrase that fits in to what Hare Elu. Because what the Talmud has done is, it set the scene for us. It gave us, these guys are in this window. These guys are in this window. If they see each other, Hare Elu, then these are what? So where's the next punctuation? Okay, Edut Achat, that there are one group of test of witnesses, and we know that because the next word is Ve'im, Ve'im. Ve'im means and if. So and if clearly is setting up another possibility or another solution to what's going on here. Ve'im lav, lav is a negating word. Ve'im lav, in other words, what? Remember, we don't use pronouns, or we don't assume. Ve'im lav, and if there is no one on one side seeing anyone on the other side, you see, it's just two words that the Mishnah gives you. Ve'im lav, and if not what? So you have to fill in those blanks in order to understand. So we said before, if somebody on one side sees somebody on the other side, in group A, part of group A sees group B, somebody in group B, so group A and group B all of a sudden become the combined group C, okay? However, if nobody in group A sees anybody in group B, and in group B they don't see anybody in group A, then what do you have? You have group A, and you have group B. Okay? Again, you have to talk it out. If you don't talk it out, it gets lost. Is everybody with me? Everybody understanding this, the case and the scene as has been set up? Okay? Good. If we move on, I got nods from most of the people, so I'm gonna move on from there. Okay? Ve'im lav, and if not, in other words, if you don't have anybody on one side seeing anybody on the other side, Hare Elu, that's our repeated phrase again. So what follows from Hare Elu? We have to get we saw with the first Elu that they become Edus Achas, they become one group of testimony. Okay, so now we have our second Elu, Hare Elu, Ve'im lav, and if they did not see one another, then Hare Elu, what are they? Shtei Edios. Okay, two groups of witnesses. Alright? So that's pretty straightforward in terms of how the Mishnah is to be read. Now we have a star. What does that star tell us? That star sends us straight across the page, folks, into what? The Mesorat HaShas. And there we have a bracketed phrase that says La'el Hei. What is La'el Hei? So one phrase, the two words which you're going to see very often in any tractate, in any Masechet, in the Mesorat HaShas is La'el and La'kamon. La'el means it appeared earlier. Earlier. And La'kamon means it's going to appear later. Okay? La'el, La'el, an easy way to remember it is Al. What's Al? Up. Up. So what does up mean? Well, if you're starting a book from page one and you're making your way down through the book, so up means
before.
Earlier, right? Earlier. Okay? And Lekaman is not La'el, not up. So it comes, it's what's coming. Or Lekaman is actually coming. What's coming? Lekaman, that's a good, I remember learning it that way. Lekaman, if you read Lekaman that way, it sounds like coming. What's coming? Something which is coming is later on in the book. Okay, so Le'el and Lekaman. Actually, if you look down, go all the way down the Mesorat HaShas, after the big, big, big space, you're going to see a Lekaman there. You guys see it? Okay, it's about 7 lines from the bottom of the Talmudic text in the margin. Lekaman. Okay, so you see those two terms, Le'el and Lekaman. Get back into the Mishnah. Lefikach. Lefikach means therefore. We should all know that word from the Seder, okay, because it's in the Haggadah. Lefikach anachnu chayavim laodos. We're obligated to thank, but that's not what it says here. Im nimtzeis
Achas mehem zomemes, hu vehein neheragin veashnia petura. Okay? Now, we have to understand what this means. That's the phrase. Now, how do I know that's a good place to stop? Because of what comes afterwards. What comes afterwards is Rabbi Yossi Omer. That indicates a new line. So now let's talk this through. Lefikach. Therefore, im nimtzes, if we find, or if it is found, achas mehen, that one of them, zomemes, that's a phrase you have to know when it comes to witnesses. Zomein. What is a zomein? Yeah, a false witnesses. So there's a rule in the Torah. Okay, the rule in the Torah is that if witnesses are found to be zomemim, basically they're lying. Okay? So the rule is that you do to them what they were trying to do to the person that they were accusing. That's the rule. Again, how often that actually is carried out is an interesting discussion. The Talmud in Makos on the page after this says that if there's a court that kills people with any sense of regularity, there are different opinions. One is pretty frequently. One is every 7 years. One opinion is once every 70 years. And they're considered to be a murderous court. Okay, so you get an idea of what the Talmud views as being the role of capital punishment. Okay, so that's not something which they wanted to do. But in any case, a lot of the Talmudic discussion are in the realm of the theoretical and hypothetical. Im nimtzes achas mehem zomemes. So if you find that one of them, so remember, no pronouns. One of them. One of what?
One of the witnesses.
Well, what does that really matter? One of the witnesses or one of the groups of witnesses? Okay, if you have one person who is found to be a liar, so they're just thrown out. There's no issue here. They've just become invalidated witnesses. So im nimtzes, if you find, remember, what's the root of nimtzes? Matzah. Matzah means to find. Im nimtzes, achas mehen, one of them. One of them means one of the pairs of witnesses. Zomemes, who vehein neheragin vehashnia petura. Who? What does who mean? He. What's he? The perpetrator of the crime. Vehein and the other one, and they, the bad pair, the ones which are proven to be false witnesses, they are killed. Vehashnia petura. Vehashnia. And the second pair of witnesses are petura, they are exempt. So now we have to understand why. How could that be? How could it be that one group of witnesses are put to death and the perpetrator is also put to death? Yeah, no, we're talking in the realm of the theoretical. Okay, so I have to understand. How do you make witnesses no good? How do you prove that they are liars? Other witnesses have to come in and say, you weren't there. You were with us in Disney World or wherever. You weren't at that scene of that crime. We were out dinner at the restaurant, and at that same time, you guys are a bunch of liars. How can you say that you're putting somebody to death? But what's the problem for the perpetrator of the crime? You may have just canceled out witnesses in Tower A, right? So they can get killed because they're trying to get this guy killed. But what's the problem for this guy down here? You got witnesses in Tower B. So when it says, who vehein neheragin, he gets killed. Why? Because these guys are witnesses. But what's bad for him? Because these guys didn't see these guys. Now, sometimes it could be that these guys really were there. Really were there. And two other guys come along and say, we were at the restaurant together. You couldn't have been over there. So who's lying now? Right, the ones who try to get rid of these guys, they're the liars. So what do you have to do? You have to wait until somebody else comes in and says, you couldn't have said that you were in the restaurant with them. You guys, you were at the movie theater with us. There's a strange chain reaction which can happen. That's why you don't, put anybody to death right away because of the possibility that somebody else will emerge. So in other words, it has to be a headline in the newspaper, right? Yankel and Shmerel, they claim that they saw such and such. Oh, these two guys that look, oh, Yankel and Shmerel, they were with us, so they have to come in. How else are they going to know? How else are they going to know that Yankel and Shmerel might be lying? Well, there must be an announcement of some kind that lets people know to come in and to do that. Okay, so this is the beginning. Okay, so that's the first case which is set up here, and it just follows based on the conversation. Now, what's going to happen in the Talmud is going to start asking questions about why you need two, for example. Okay, what if the witnesses come along and they say, you know, one of you was with us and the other guy was actually there? Because it could be, you know, let's say I see something and I go over to my friend and I say, hey, look, I saw this, and I can tell you every detail of what happened. And then my friend might say, you know what, I feel like I was there. All right, let's go in and let's get the perpetrator. He's guilty. So my friend was somewhere else. He wasn't at the crime, but I gave him all the information. He can come in and he can say with me, if he wants to play this game, that he knows everything and I know everything and we both gave the same information. Now witnesses are going to come in and say, hey, Frank, you weren't there. You were with us because we were playing golf. And he said, oh, you know, all right, well, that's him. But I was there, and they can't say that I was playing golf with them because I actually saw it. So what that does is that nullifies our group as a group, but it doesn't put us to death for trying to get this guy put to death, because was our group nullified together?
Just one of them.
Just one of them. So that's another rule. Adim Zomin, they're in it together. So if they are both disqualified, then we have a problem for them. But if only one of them is disqualified, their testimony is thrown out, but they're not put to death because they're not viewed as a pair which can suffer the consequence of what they're trying to do to the other person. I was there. They can't prove me wrong because I was present. My buddy, he was not there. So he gets into a bind, but nothing can be done to him.
Wait, he's not put to death?
No, because the witnesses, they're in it together in the sense that if it's proven that they're both liars, but they can't, in the case that I just gave, they can't prove that I'm a liar because I wasn't with them. I actually was there.
Your testimony doesn't count because now you're
to punish.
Wrong.
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Why did I bring this guy? Because I know that I can't punish the murderer unless there are two. And there had to have been a warning. So we have to come along and give all this information. But if our information is proved to be inaccurate, then our testimony is thrown out. But if they can't prove us both liars, then I'm not going to be put to death. And therefore, he's not going to be put to death. Okay? Let's continue. Rabbi Yossi. Okay? Right, Rabbi Yossi is actually going to say, that's something else. Rabbi Yossi Omer. So now, that introduces to us a quote. Now our question is, where does the Rabbi Yossi quote end? Okay? So we go through this, and we're going to see on the next line a code word. What's the code word? Shene'emar. You see that word, Shene'emar? Shene'emar means as it says. And Shene'emar typically introduces a quote from the Bible. Very often the Torah, but it could, as I mentioned last week, the Torah or can quote from places which are not only the Torah. It can be any place in Tanakh, in the 24 books of the Tanakh. It happens to be that this quote is from the Torah, and this quote is from where? Devarim 17. Devarim 17. That's the parsha of Shoftim. Okay, and so what we're going to do now is I'm actually going to look up the pasuk while we're here. I saw Chumash here. I know there's one there. But I just want to find. Here we go. Chumash. Okay, Devarim 17. So let's take a look. Okay, let's make our way through Rabbi Yossi's quote, and when we finish the mission, we'll be done for this evening. You're going to have to bring this packet next time because we're going to continue into the Talmud with the things which are with the pages which I gave you in the handout. But you can't do Talmud without doing Mishnah. So you always have to start with the Mishnah. Okay, so here we go. This is Devarim 17. So let's read through the passage while I'm finding it in the Chumash. Rabbi Yossi Omer. Let's translate word for word. Le'olam. What does le'olam mean?
Forever.
Always. A rule. Ein neharagin ad sheyit. So where should I pause, folks? Ein neheragin. Ein is a negating word. It usually negates the following word. Ein neheragin. You don't kill. Ad. What's ad? Until. Sheyehu. That you have. Shnei. Two. A dove. Of his witnesses. In other words, the two witnesses. Masrin. Masrin is like that word hasra. We had that before. Masrin. Warning bow. You have to warn the guy. You have to have two witnesses warning the guy. Shenamar. As it says in the Torah, in chapter 17, Alpi, here we go, I got the pasuk right away. Okay? Alpi, based on Shnei Edim. Now, how much of the quote did he give you? Alpi Shnei Edim. That's all that it gives you. Okay? That's all the quote. Here's the quote from the rest of the pasuk. Alpi, based on the word of Shnei Edim, two witnesses. O, or Alpi Shlosh Edim. I'm reading from the Chumash, folks. Okay? When the Torah, when the Gemara, when the Talmud, Mishnah, whatever, gives you a quote from a pasuk, it's always, always essential that you look up the pasuk and find it and know the context. Okay? And of course, the full message of the verse. The assumption that the Mishnah makes is that you know it. If you don't know it, then you must look it up, because that's the assumption that it's making. So it happens to be 17 verse 15. Chapter 17, verse 15. And I know it's chapter 17 because the Torah or tells me that. So lo yakum edechav ish. Oh, so actually that's the whole sentence. One witness must not testify against a person. L'chol avon l'chol chatas, to inflict any punishment or penalty. B'chol chet asher yachatav, for a crime that he may have committed. Rather, al pi shnei edim, a case has to be established with the testimony of at least two. O al pi shlosha edim yakum davar, or three witnesses. That's how you will figure out what's going on. So that's the rule, and that's what the verse that Rabbi Yossi is quoting. How do you know that you can't kill anybody unless you have two witnesses who are warning? Al pi, based on the mouth of the shnei edim, of the two witnesses, they both must tell the guy, hey buddy, you can't do what you're about to do. Do we have that here in any part of the case of the Mishnah? No. We either had two witnesses up there and one guy warning, or they weren't even giving a warning at all. So if there's one guy warning, even either it's a guy down there warning or one of them warning. It's not so clear from the Mishnah what's going on, but that's what you have. Either one guy down below who was not a two-person witness group, or one person up in the tower, in the window, giving a warning, but not both. So, Alpi Shnayim Edim. That's the quote. How do you know that that's the end of the quote from the Pasuk? Because when you look it up, and you see that the next word that's in the Mishnah is not in the Pasuk, you know it is not, you know that the end of the Mishnah's quote of the Pasuk has arrived. That's why you have to look it up. Because otherwise you keep reading as if this is a quote from the Pasuk. And how did you know it was a quote from a Pasuk? There were two indicators. Anyone remember? Two indicators in the Talmud. The word Shenamar and? Right, and the little circle. Those are the two indicators that a Pasuk is being quoted. And the way you find the end of the Pasuk, or at least the end of the quote of the Pasuk that appears here, is through looking it up. Because sometimes all that they need to give you is a small part of the Pasuk. And that's what they needed here, to tell you that it's Alpi Shnayim Edim. Davar Acher. So now, Davar Acher, that's a phrase that you appear a lot. And that is the Mishnah's way of saying, hold on a second, I actually have another interpretation of what Alpi Shnayim Edim means. So is this relevant to Rabbi Yossi's point? No, it's not. Rabbi Yossi's point was that you need to have warning from two people, and if you don't have a warning from two people, there's nothing to talk about. Okay? But the Mishnah is saying, oh, you know what? You've given one interpretation of Alpi Shnayim Edim, and it's based on the mouth of two witnesses. So now I'm going to give you another interpretation of the mouth of two witnesses. Davar Acher. Another interpretation of that phrase that you just quoted from the Pasuk. The Mishnah is going to conclude by giving us another example of what that means. And how is it going to tell us that? Alpi Shnayim Edim. Well, what is that? Based on what we saw before, one of our earlier rules tonight. What is Alpi Shnayim Edim? It's a repeat. Right? Remember, it's a repeat of the same phrase. What's the phrase? That's the quote from the Pasuk. So when it says Davar Acher, here you see that it's repeating the phrase that we just read on the line before. Right? Circle, Alpi Shnayim Edim Davar Acher. Oh, wait a second. Davar Acher does not appear in the Pasuk. I just looked that up. So Davar Acher tells me something. Is there anything else that's attached to Davar Acher? Well, the next four words are Alpi Shnayim Edim. Hey, wait a second. You just repeated what the quote from the Pasuk was. So what's the Mishnah telling us? That Davar Acher, I have another interpretation of Alpi Shnayim Edim. And I know that because I am paying attention to what I read. And a moment ago, I read those four words. And now the Mishnah is telling them to me again. So if the Mishnah is telling them to me again, that means that they are a re-quote of the Pasuk. So why do I not have that little circle? Because I don't need the little circle. Okay? Because it just told me. And I know that. It's not going to tell me that this is a quote again of the Pasuk, which it just told me half a line ago that this is a quote from that Pasuk. I know that. So what's the Davar Acher? Alpi Shnayim Edim. Shelo Tehei Sanhedrin Shoma'as Mipi HaTurgamon. Let's do each word. Shelo. That it should not. Tehei. Have. Be. Okay, you should not have Sanhedrin. What's the Sanhedrin? That's the court. Okay. Shoma'as. What's the root of Shoma'as? We should all know that word. Shomea. Shema. What does that mean? Listen, they shouldn't hear. Mipi. From the mouth of HaTurgamon. Turgamon is an interpreter. Okay, so what does that mean? Well, one of the rules of being on the Sanhedrin is that you need to speak many, the people on the Sanhedrin needed to understand a lot of languages. Okay, there's no question that if the judge or whoever's listening to the case can understand the witnesses, it's a much better situation than if you have a translator. Because the translator could mistranslate or can lie. Okay, it could totally change things. So the other interpretation of Alpi Shnayim Edim means that it's not so much about the witnesses, but it's a reminder to the Sanhedrin, to the court, whoever is on the court, that they have to hear Alpi based on the mouth of the witnesses directly. And not, now, is that relevant to everything that we've said up until now? No, but that's what Davar Acher is. That it's just giving us another interpretation. And that's okay. We're going to find that a lot. We're a little tangent, a little side point, but the point is that once the redactor of the Mishnah said, oh, there's Alpi Shnayim Edim, okay, so I'm just going to tell you there happens to be another interpretation of what that means. Does that change anything insofar as how we understand it? Does it change Rabbi Yossi's opinion? No, it doesn't change Rabbi Yossi's opinion. Does it negate Rabbi Yossi's opinion? No, it doesn't negate Rabbi Yossi's opinion. It just tells us another meaning of Alpi Shnayim Edim. Is the Gemara going to address that second interpretation? Yeah, the Gemara is probably going to address that second interpretation because the Gemara does that all the time. But what we've seen here is how to work through a Mishnah. So the key things that we saw here tonight, just to summarize, we saw that little aleph from the Rambam. We saw the little star that tells us to look, that this is discussed elsewhere in the Talmud. I didn't give you that page, so we didn't look it up. The Rabbi Yossi also appears elsewhere. The idea of having two witnesses warning also appears elsewhere. These are the different stars, the asterisks, that appear in this passage. We saw a pasuk being quoted, and we saw it quoted twice. And that brought us to the main rule which we saw of the evening in terms of punctuation. Paying attention to what you're reading, because if a phrase what? Repeats, that helps you punctuate the sentence, and it helps you find where a break is. It doesn't always give it to you automatically, but it helps. And one other thing that we saw, I didn't focus heavily on it, but when you see a name, and a name is very often introduced by a title, like Rabbi, Rav, Rabban, when you see a name, you'll usually find the word Omer, or Amar, which means he said. And that also indicates to us a quotation, and so we have to find the end of the quotation. And how do we find the end of the quotation? If we're reading through the phrase, what we need to find basically where an idea that he is presenting comes to its conclusion. So what do you think? Is Davar Acher part of Rabbi Yossi's teaching? It could be that it's not. And it likely is not. On the other hand, it could be that it is. So that's why you have people like Rashi, or that's why you look up where it says Rabbi Yossi, and you see what the full quote is in that other place. So the Rabbi Yossi quote appears in Sanhedrin. Okay, it looks like a test. Pesim and Beis. Okay, so you look up Rabbi Yossi over there, and you see how much of what appears here is there. If the Davar Acher is not there, then Rabbi Yossi's quote ends before the Davar Acher. If the Davar Acher does appear there, then Rabbi Yossi's quote includes all of that. Depends on what you see in that other place. Okay? So please, bring these. I will leave a bunch of these here for next time, just in case you forget it. And that is our lesson for this evening.